Welcome to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast for November 2010. I'm your host, Don Cameron of Cameron McKendrick LLP in Toronto, Canada. We hope you'll find this podcast informative, but it should not be taken as legal advice. The opinions expressed are solely those of the participants. This month's podcast deals with two topics: the false marking patent cases coming out of the United States, and Canada's recent decision on the patentability of business methods in the Amazon one-click decision. The U.S. Patent Act provides that you cannot recover damages for patent infringement unless you can prove that either the defendant had actual notice of the patent, or you'd marked your patent or its packaging with a notice of the word patent or pat, together with the patent number or numbers whose inventions are embodied in the product. However, should you wrongly mark your unpatented product with the word patent or anything else that conveys the message that the product is patented for the purpose of deceiving the public, you can be fined up to $500 per offense. Half the fine goes to the government, and half the fine goes to the whistleblower who brings the case forward. Enterprising plaintiffs, usually patent attorneys themselves, have been bringing cases under the false marking section of the U.S. Patent Act. Solo makes plastic coffee cup lids. They had put the patent numbers in the molds used to make the coffee cup lids, but they'd continued to use the same molds after the patents had expired on over 21 billion cup lids. The question was whether each of the 21.7 billion falsely marked lids would generate a $500 fine. The Federal Circuit did the math. The potential fine payable to the U.S. government would have been $5.4 trillion, enough to pay off almost half of the U.S. national debt. There were two sets of product at issue in the Solo case: those that had been covered by a patent, but the patent had now expired, and those that were not covered by a patent, but whose packaging bore notice that they, quote, may be covered by one or more patents, end quote. Tom Williams is a partner in the Chicago office of Howry LLP and specializes in trademark law, but he's spending an increasing amount of his time lately working on patent false marking cases. I spoke with Tom from his office in Chicago. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Don.
The Solo case, I thought, was originally a Solo case, but it turns out it's not. What statistics have you got on how many of these cases have been filed just this year?
As it appears right now, in late November of 2010, there have been over 500 patent false marking cases filed in federal district courts across the country.
So it's become a new industry in the patent litigation regime.
It really has. This provision has been in the Patent Act for over 150 years with minor amendments over time, but it's only been in the last couple of years, and then particularly after some Federal Circuit decisions in 2009 and 2010, that this piece of the Patent Act, Section 292, has become, as you pointed out, really a cottage industry.
So let's talk about the Solo case itself. It's my understanding that the court was dealing with two categories of products, one that had been covered by a patent and one that had not been covered by a patent. What did the court do with respect to each of those?
Yes, the court looked at two types of patent marking used by the Solo Cup Company. The first form of patent marking, really the first accused form of patent marking, was marking of products with patent numbers that had expired. And in that case, the court held that, yes, in fact, marking a product with a patent number that has now expired can constitute a false marking or a patent mismarking for 292 purposes.
And then there was another category of product that I think they had indicated that the product may be covered by one or more patents. How did the court dispose of that kind of notice?
Yes, that's correct. The district court held that marking a product that had never been covered by a patent, essentially an unpatentable product, with the phrase may be covered by a patent and then listing a series of patent numbers, would in fact be a mismarking if the product had never been covered by a patent. But I think it's important to point out that under either of those mismarkings, either marking with an expired patent or marking an unpatented product, the plaintiff would still, in order to recover, need to prove that the marking was done with an intent to deceive the public.
So what's the burden of proof in a case like this?
Well, that's an interesting question. And if you listen to the audio of the Federal Circuit appellate court argument in this case, there were a lot of minutes devoted to that specific question, because the statute is civil but it's quasi-criminal because it provides for a fine. So the court ultimately decided that the standard of proof, the burden of proof, would be the preponderance of the evidence standard.
Well, let's talk then about the presumptions that are created in this type of circumstance. Where the statements are false or were known to be false, what presumption does that create?
Yes, the Federal Circuit has held that where the proofs establish that the statements were in fact false, the markings were false, and that the party making the statements or doing the markings knew that the markings were false, that does trigger a rebuttable presumption of intent to deceive the public.
So at that point, does the burden of proof shift to people like Solo to rebut the presumption?
Yes. If the plaintiff puts forth proof of both of those elements, falsity and knowledge of the falsity, then the burden shifts to the defendant or the party who had done the patent marking to prove also by a preponderance of the evidence that it lacked the intent to deceive.
And what sort of evidence did Solo use in its case to rebut that presumption of the intention to deceive?
Well, that was really the crux of the Solo case. The Solo case really turned on the intent to deceive issue, and the court held and the Federal Circuit affirmed that Solo did in fact successfully rebut that presumption of deceptive intent. Now, Solo, interestingly, waived its attorney-client privilege and actually divulged communications between it and its attorney showing that it was operating under the advice of counsel with respect to its patent marking practices. Another piece of evidence Solo had was witness testimony. Solo's in-house witnesses actually explained and justified Solo's patent marking processes, and they explained that, particularly in the case of the expired patents, these patent numbers were affixed to machinery that molded the product at issue, which was a couplet. And the molds were actually expensive to replace, and Solo had a plan in place to replace those molds as they wore out, but they would continue using the molds while they were still functional. And Solo had legal advice explaining that that would in fact be consistent or not in violation of Section 292.
And what about the notice that was on the product that they may be covered by patents? Did that help them at all in terms of sending any kind of message to the consumer?
Yes, it did. That affected the second form of accused marking, the marking with the may be covered language. When Solo used the may be covered language, they also included a statement referring the consumer or the customer to the company's website that had additional information regarding the company's patents. And so the court also viewed that as another mitigating factor rebutting the intent to deceive.
Now, since Solo, we've seen a couple of decisions. One of them is the Stauffer and Brooks Brothers, the bow tie case. What can you tell us about what was involved in that case and decision?
Yeah, this was an interesting case. A lot of pending cases were suspended in light of the Federal Circuit taking the Stauffer Brooks Brother case up on appeal. This case came down to who, in fact, has standing to pursue a false marking claim. Can an individual who suffered no competitive harm bring a false marking case under Section 292? And the Federal Circuit held in the Stauffer case that yes, in fact, any person can bring these cases because that person is actually standing in the shoes of the U.S. government. So this actually affirmed the the practice of a number of non-competitor plaintiffs are bringing these cases. It's, as we discussed earlier, a lot of these plaintiffs are, in fact, patent lawyers. And the Stauffer decision affirmed the non-competitive plaintiff's ability to bring these cases in federal court.
As you said, boldly litigating where no one has litigated before.
Exactly.
In terms of these cases, I understand the government can intervene. Has it taken any role in these proceedings?
It has. The government actually sought to intervene in the Stauffer v. Brooks Brothers case, and the trial court judge declined that intervention. The Federal Circuit, in ruling on the standing question, also overruled the district court judge on the intervention question, affirming, in effect, the federal government's ability to intervene in these cases.
So where are you seeing most of these cases being litigated? Are there fora that are more popular than others?
There are two district courts that seem to get almost half of these cases, and that is the Northern District of Illinois and the Eastern District of Texas. Now, it seems that the Northern District of Illinois has been a popular forum based on a few very aggressive plaintiffs. There are a few plaintiffs in the Chicago area who have filed numerous false marking cases, and that skews the numbers in the Northern District of Illinois' favor. As far as the Eastern District of Texas, that has been a popular forum for U.S. patent plaintiffs for several years now. It's seen as a plaintiff-friendly jurisdiction. It was one of the first courts to adopt specific local rules dealing with patent cases. So presumably that has had some impact on plaintiffs' desire to bring cases down there.
What other wrinkles do you see in the future for these types of cases? What sort of arguments do you think are going to be raised by either side?
Well, the first skirmish involved jurisdiction and personal jurisdiction over these defendants. Courts have been fairly willing to transfer these cases back to the home jurisdiction of the defendants, even if the defendants had enough sales in the plaintiff's forum. Courts have been fairly amenable to transferring these cases back to the defendant's home jurisdiction. The bigger issue right now is pleadings. How do you plead a 292 violation? Courts have held, for the most part, that Federal Rule 9B, which is applicable to fraud-based claims, is applicable to Section 292 of the Patent Act. That's going to be before the Federal Circuit in the near future, but the majority of the trial courts who have looked at it have held that Federal Rule 9B applies, meaning that a plaintiff has to plead its false marking claim, quote-unquote, with particularity. And that's proven difficult for plaintiffs because they, until they get discovery, don't have much, if any, information regarding the intent behind the false marking, or the alleged false marking. So plaintiffs now have become increasingly sophisticated in drafting their pleadings, taking the position that if they can allege enough facts establishing that the defendant is, in fact, a quote-unquote sophisticated patentee, that leads to an inference of an intent to deceive. And I think at some point in the near future, the appellate court is going to have to weigh in on the fundamental pleading requirements to get across the line in drafting one of these false marking complaints.
So what's the right advice for clients who might be facing these types of cases or who want to avoid facing these types of cases?
You need a plan. A patent marker really needs to have a plan as to how it's going to mark its products going forward. There's really not a one-size-fits-all type of plan. It's going to depend on your client's products, your client's patent portfolio, and its objectives in marking its products with patent numbers. So the most important thing that a patentee needs to do right now is to sit down with its patent counsel and hammer out a plan that fits the company.
Thanks very much for these insights, Tom.
My pleasure. It's an interesting topic.
For the second part of this podcast, we move north to Canada and look at what the Federal Court of Canada did recently when confronted with Amazon.com's one-click system and a patent application for it. On October 14, 2010, Mr. Justice Phelan of the Federal Court of Canada handed down a very well-reasoned decision in the Amazon.com case. Amazon's patent application related to its one-click online purchasing system that stored a cookie in the user's computer that Amazon could use the next time a purchase was made. Amazon could then recognize the purchaser and recall the purchasing information that had previously been entered. The purchaser could purchase an item with a single click and not have to go through the checkout system every time. There was no question that the system was new and inventive. The question was whether it was an art or process under the Patent Act's definition of invention. The Commissioner of Patents had decided that the one-click system was not a patentable art or process. Justice Phelan decided that it was patentable subject matter. In brief, Justice Phelan decided that in Canada, a business method can be patented in appropriate circumstances. Justice Phelan found that the Commissioner had erred at just about every step along the way. Firstly, the Commissioner said that you had to look beyond the mere form of the claim and instead look to what was the substance of the invention. Although the claims on their face were for a process or a machine, in substance, both defined a method. Justice Phelan held that the Commissioner made a fundamental mistake in relying on jurisprudence from England and the European systems based on the European Patent Convention. Under those systems, methods of doing business as such are expressly excluded from being inventions. The Canadian Patent Act was modeled after the U.S. Patent Act, not the U.K. Act, and therefore English law cannot be adopted unthinkingly. Justice Phelan confirmed that the Commissioner is bound by the Canadian patent regime and its interpretation by the courts. He said that many of her errors stemmed from her adopting a policy role and importing policies that were not consistent with Canadian law. Justice Phelan said that since free world, claims are to be interpreted in a purposive manner. The Supreme Court firmly rejected the previous form and substance approach. A subjective examination into the substance of the claims would lead to uncertainty. He found that a return to the form and substance language was confusing and unnecessary, and a departure from the Supreme Court's clear direction to apply a purposive construction. The Commissioner also held that a claimed invention is not patentable if what makes it new and non-obvious was, in itself, non-statutory subject matter. In this case, what was added or discovered was limited to streamlining the ordering methods and the benefits that came from this. Justice Phelan held that it's not wrong to ask what has been invented, so long as this is determined with reference to the essential elements as disclosed through a purposive construction of the claims, rather than through a subjective secondary consideration by the Patent Office as to the substance of the invention. By rejecting purposive construction, the Commissioner allowed herself to parse the claims into novel and non-novel components. Asking the question as to what has been discovered does not stand apart from the claims as a whole. It's contrary to settled law to look at what had been invented by failing to look at the invention as a whole. In determining whether the invention was an art under Section 2, the Commissioner stressed the physical nature of inventions. To her, inventions were either physical objects or a change in character or condition of a physical object. If they weren't physical in nature, or produced a series of acts performed by a physical agent on a physical object to produce some change or effect, then they were not patentable arts or processes. In the one-click case, the Commissioner decided that there was no change in the physical condition of the goods ordered, only in how the order was placed. Justice Phelan pointed out that in the Shell case, the Supreme Court of Canada held that an art must be a practical application of learning or knowledge. The Commissioner decided that this knowledge must be scientific or technological. In the case of the one-click method, most of the steps were not technological and no technical effect had been added to human knowledge. Although the Shell case was the right starting point for the analysis of what is a patentable art, Justice Phelan took from Shell that a new and useful art is the practical application of a discovery, learning, or knowledge to effect a desired result that has a commercially useful result. The art must be a practical application rather than a mere scheme or disembodied or abstract idea. It must be concrete and tangible. This requires some sort of manifestation or effect or change in character, such as an act or series of acts performed by some physical agent upon some physical object and producing in such object some change either of character or of condition. But it's important to remain focused on the requirement of practical application rather than merely the physicality of the invention. The language in the Lawson case must not be interpreted to restrict the patentability of practical applications which might, in light of today's technology, consist of a slightly less conventional change in character or effect, such as one made through a machine such as a computer. For example, in the Progressive Games case, a case involving a new way to play poker, the manipulation of the cards was enough to constitute a practical application of the idea. With respect to the commissioner's requirement that an invention must be technological in nature, Justice Phelan held that the new and useful knowledge need not be scientific or technological in order to constitute a patentable art. Even if patents generally cover the protection of advances of technology broadly defined, introducing a technological test into the Canadian patent system would render it overly restrictive, confusing, highly subjective, and provide little predictability. Technology is in such a state of flux that to attempt to define it would serve to defeat the flexibility which is so crucial to the Patent Act. In applying these tests to the Amazon one-click invention, Justice Phelan held, the system claims disclosed a machine. The process claims as a whole claimed an invention that was a process which used stored information and cookies to enable customers to order over the internet simply by clicking on them. An online ordering system which facilitates the one-click method adds to the state of knowledge in this area. The new learning or knowledge is not simply a plan or scheme. It is a practical application of the one-click concept put into action through the use of cookies, computers, the internet, and the customer's own action. Tangibility is not an issue. The physical effect, transformation, or change of character resides in the customer manipulating their computer and creating an order. It didn't matter that the goods ordered were not physically changed. This invention has a commercially applicable result and is concerned with trade, industry, and commerce. In light of all these factors, the court found the process claims to be patentable as an art and process. The commissioner found that the claims were also excluded because they were a business method. To patent the wood, in her view, require a radical departure from the current regime. According to Justice Phelan, however, there is no tradition of excluding business methods from patentability in Canada. There is not, nor has there ever been, a statutory exclusion for business methods in Canada as there is in the United Kingdom. In the USA, all methods, including business methods, are subject to the same requirements as other inventions under the Act. To implement a business method exemption would be a radical departure from the current regime requiring parliamentary intervention. The government has since filed an appeal from Justice Phelan's decision. I'll keep you posted on further developments in the Amazon.com one-click patent case. My guest for this podcast has been Tom Williams, a partner in the Chicago office of Howry LLP. For further information on the Solo Cup case and on the Amazon.com one-click decision from the Federal Court of Canada, please visit iplawpodcast.com. My name is Don Cameron. You've been listening to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast. Thank you for listening.